Thank you, Charles, for leading us in those good songs. Those of you who are visiting with us, we're thankful for your presence. We hope you'll come back and be with us whenever you can. Next Sunday, after the second hour of worship, we'll have our newcomers' dinner. All the people who've placed membership with this congregation over the last year are invited to meet and eat with the elders and their wives and the deacons and their wives and Terry and me and our wives and the office staff. We want to introduce you to as many people as we can, and we want to start with the elders and their wives particularly and the deacons and their wives, and we're urging you to be making your plans to be here for that hour of fellowship tomorrow, next Sunday morning after the second worship hour. Well, initiation week is over, finally. Did you all make it? I guess you lived through it. We've all got mixed emotions about initiation week. Something that tipped the scales in its favor, though, this week for me. Someone said this old boy that never had had a date in his life was required to have 30 dates last week. 30. And I just simply thanked the Lord and I said, long live initiation week. If we can turn it into what it is called, really an initiation week, where the men on the campus start initiating and being the initiators, that may be all right too. I think you ought to look at the word stagnation. Wherever there's no initiation on the part of men, there results stagnation. And you know where the word stag comes from? Stagnation. And these stags, these men, you know, that don't ever get married, that when you end up being a stag, or you go to a stag party, I'm convinced, though I haven't checked it, but I suspect that the same word, it derives from that same root, stag or stagnation. You know what a pond of water that doesn't run? It's stagnant. Stagnant. And does it ever smell? And so it is with a bunch of men now who don't initiate and don't get things going. You cause a situation that's stagnant, and that you cause stagnation. You pardon the word study, and let's just think about it. I wish that fellow that asked for 30 dates would stand up and give a testimony, but there were several of you that had an opportunity to ask for dates. I got asked for one, and I accepted. She gave me a sucker and asked if I would accept that as a Coke date, and I said, you bet your life. And I wrote my name in her book, and she was so tickled. She was desperate, evidently. Did you know that in England, religious conditions are so far developed toward decay that the Church of England, that boasts some 20 million members on their rolls, can muster, even at Easter time, only about 2 million people in their assemblies? 20 million members, and at Easter time, only about 2 million. And those that assemble at the Easter services of the Church of England, they outnumber the ordinary services by perhaps 100 to 1. I suspect that at their ordinary weekly services, they wouldn't have 100,000 people all over the world. And yet they claim 20 million members. 10 years ago, they passed resolutions that would endorse homosexuality. That's getting pretty far down the road. But that's not anything, really. America, who usually is about 20 years behind England's decay, has already not only endorsed homosexuality among certain religious groups, but they are already ordaining religious clergy who are homosexuals. Certain religious groups have already proclaimed that God is dead, that Jesus Christ is really not deity. You can just name any kind of religious debauchery that you can imagine, and someone, either in England or America or Germany or some other civilized country, has already discovered it and has already determined that they're going to propagate this religious debauchery. In 1967, and that's the last dates that I have, I'm sorry, I have nothing later than that, but the things that would be later would be worse. In 1967, in America, 9,000 churches closed their doors. 60,000 churches in that year made no converts whatsoever, none. You could go on stating statistics that would perhaps curdle our blood and make us be chilled with foreboding. But that won't be our purpose this morning. But I just simply want to ask us the question, can religion survive? Now, we're standing right in the middle of what we noticed last Sunday to be, at least in my estimation and the estimation of others who are more qualified than I, the post-Christian era. Do you think that the church or that religion can survive this time in which we're living? Well, yes, I'm sure it will. Because man will not live without religion. Now, it may be a false religion, but man is going to have him something to worship. He may worship mammon and make that his religion. Or he may worship science and make that his religion. Or he may come in with some kind of kinky, new, fangled innovation and make that his religion. But whether it be true or false religion, mankind is going to see to it that he has a religion. But you might then narrow it on down a bit and ask, do you think that Christendom can survive the present age? And yes, I'm convinced that Christendom will. In the broadest sense of the term, there has been a resurgence in religious interest, but there's also been a resurgence in biblical interest and biblical emphasis. Many of these who have this resurgence of biblical emphasis don't really yet have a perspective or yet have a clear concept of what God really wants of them. They have no inheritance, they have no background of religion, but they're simply people who are clamoring for an answer. And whether it even result in some type of cult, even the cults and the existence of cults today, that is some kind of an indication that religion, even Christendom, will survive this present age in which we're living. And we're seeing a grassroots resurgence of biblical interest, and I'm thankful for that. But I want to ask you even more specifically, do you believe that the church can survive this present age? I mean us. Do you think we can survive this present age? You see, there has come pretty well to a standstill our growth. We're not growing like we should have been growing. We're not growing like we were growing from 1945 through 1965. In the last 10 years, there's been a stagnation. There's been a slowing down of our growth rate. Do you think we'll survive? Someone has projected that if we go at the same rate that we're going today, by 1985, there will be not only a leveling off, but there will begin a decline in our numbers until eventually, unless something is done to change that, we'll evaporate. We will disappear as a movement. We'll stop existing as a people. Do you think that you and I can grasp a new vision of our purpose? Young people and old alike, do you think we can sharpen our perception about our task and our purpose and our goals and our direction? If we don't, you mark it down, we're one of the latter and one of the last generations of the church in America. We'll not long survive unless we ourselves in this age, who have a good number of years ahead of us, sharpen our perception as to our purpose and rededicate ourselves as far as our direction is concerned and reconsecrate ourselves to the task that lies ahead of us. We're simply not going to make it unless we do this. And I direct these questions primarily to the two generations that we'll know today as the younger ones. And I mean those two as that generation of mine. And there are a lot of us in here who are in this generation from, say, the age 30 up through the 60s. And then the second generation, those who are in their teens up to the 30s. These two generations will have to answer this question. Those who are older, those who are in their 70s and their 80s, they've already just about completed what they can do. They can keep doing what they're doing. But what they have done has already registered with those of us who are in these two lower age groups. And so I say that if the church is to survive in America, it'll have to survive with you and me. Listen, the buck stops with you and me. The day I realized that, a cold chill broke out over my back. I began to be sweaty in the palms of my hands. I sat there in my chair the day I realized, all right, Buster, the buck stops with you. You need not look to somebody else to fight the battles. You need not look to somebody else to preach the message. You need not look for anybody else to maintain the purity. You need not look to somebody else to set the vision. If you can't set it yourself, it won't be set. Your generation, I said to myself, the buck stops with you. And that's true. And that's a very awesome and a sobering thought. I don't relish it. I didn't want it. And I would to God that I didn't have to accept it, but I've had to accept it. And so I challenge you today, those of you who are my age, the buck has stopped with us. Either we maintain the purity of the church and extend its life down on through another generation, or it won't be done. For this simple reason, apostasy is always just one generation away. Always. Now this is graphically illustrated in the generation that followed Joshua. I beg you with all that's in me to think creatively with me today. I hope to startle you and I hope to jar you. I'm not going to quote statistics. I want to just simply tell you two stories. One about the story of the generation that succeeded Joshua. Joshua and the children of Israel who followed him, his peers and he, seemed to be a breakthrough in God's task of bringing upon the earth a nation of people that would follow him. Joshua was the general of the Jewish people, the Israelites. Joshua succeeded Moses. And Joshua and his peers, these younger people who were just maybe 10 or 15 years younger than Joshua at the Exodus from Egypt, these young people under Joshua were teenagers. They were teenagers. The rest of the people, 20 years old and upward, except for Caleb and Joshua, were destroyed in the wilderness. Those teenagers, though, who left Egypt with Joshua, and Joshua was one of those who were older, perhaps in his 20s or maybe his 30s, but it was Joshua and his younger peers who provided a real live connection between the following generation and the preceding generation that was present at the time of the Exodus from Egypt. They were that vital link in between that succeeding generation and the preceding generation. And it seemed like that perhaps with those men and those women and those young people, there was a real breakthrough. Because in Joshua, the 24th chapter in verse 31, it says, "And Israel served the Lord all the days of Joshua and all the days of the elders." I want you to turn in there in your Bibles if you have it. We're going to be looking in Joshua and in Judges just for a moment. Joshua 24:31, "And Israel served the Lord." I'm going to wait on you to turn to it because I want you to see it. All right, "And Israel served the Lord all the days of Joshua and all the days of the elders who outlived Joshua and had known all the work which the Lord did for Israel." And then in chapter 2 of Judges, turn over one page and you'll come to it. "And the people served the Lord all the days of Joshua and all the days of the elders who outlived Joshua, who had seen all the great work which the Lord had done for Israel." Now there's the same statement almost made identically twice. And we find that these people, Joshua and his peers, they served the Lord, and all of Israel and all of those people of Israel who were the associates of Joshua and who outlived them in a sense that they were contemporary with them but went on a bit past them, they also were true to the Lord. These witnessed the power of God in the Exodus from Egypt. These people, and you look at the Jewish nation today, the Jewish nation today is concrete evidence that somebody back there came out of Egypt. We're not talking about fairy tales. The Jewish nation has had a greater influence upon the history of the human race than any other nation in the whole history of the human race. We're where we are to a great extent because of the fact that the Jews were what they were. So we're standing today contemporaries with some of the great, 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 great grandchildren of the people who came up out of the land of Egypt. Joshua was one of those who saw that great power of God. The peers, the teenagers who came up out of Egypt with him, they saw it. And it looks like that this was the breakthrough, but it wasn't. Because after Joshua died, and after those teenagers died who had come up out of the land with Joshua, something else happened. It says in verse 10 of chapter 2, "And all that generation also were gathered to their fathers, and there arose another generation after them who did not know the Lord, or the work which he had done for Israel." Another whole generation arose. I want you to look just briefly, look with me just a moment. There was a people, Joshua, all right? He was perhaps 10 or 15 years older than the majority of the peers who came with him. You see, it was only Joshua and Caleb who survived that great trek through the wilderness. The rest of these people were 10 to 15 or 20 years younger, on down maybe to 30 to 40 years younger than Joshua. He and Caleb and their wives, they were the ones who survived in a generation almost all their own. But it was the teenagers who went with them, who then married and had children. They were the ones also who remained faithful. Listen, "And the people served the Lord all the days of Joshua, and all the days of the Israel of the elders who outlived Joshua." Now that's those teenagers. The teenagers who had grown up during that period of time of the deliverance and all, who had survived through the wilderness wandering, who had survived during the time of the conquest of Canaan, which was about 51 years by some estimates. All of these people served the Lord, and they then died. Joshua died, they died, and something happened. Look in verse 10. "And all that generation also were gathered to the fathers, and there arose another generation after them who did not know the Lord or the work which he had done for Israel." Look back at chapter 2 and verse 7. And I want you to see if you can sense something here. "And the people served the Lord all the days of Joshua and all the days of the elders who outlived Joshua." The people. Who were they? I think there's a third group here. And when I say that apostasy is always one generation away, that may not be exactly true. There may be, in between the generation and the complete apostasy, there may be a generation here of spectators. Spectators. There was a people here known as the people. The people. And you've got Joshua and the elders who outlived Joshua. You've got that generation. And then it says, "And the people also, they hung on too. They served the Lord while they had this leadership. But they didn't have any leadership among themselves." Once the leaders died, Joshua and Caleb and the teenagers who had grown up and they died, among them also there was scattered this sprinkling of people who were just known as the people. And I don't doubt but what it was not just a sprinkling. I suspect that it was the majority of the people. The people remained true as long as these others died. And then that whole generation died. Spectators and all. Leaders and spectators all died. And this new generation arose that didn't know the Lord. I wonder what happened. Well, there's some very practical explanations. Number one, perhaps they were so busy fighting that they didn't have time to teach the younger ones why they were fighting. You can do that. You can become so involved in fighting for what's right that you don't have time to sit down with your little children and say, "Now this is why we're doing it." We can do it in the church today. We can be so involved in fighting for truth and fighting for right and fighting for doctrine and for what is true that we don't have time to stop and sit and take our own little children and sit down and say, "Now, dear, this is why we're doing this." And I'll tell you what, it's prevalent on Christian college campuses for people to be so involved in fighting a brotherhood battle that they don't have time to sit down with their own children and say, "Look, this is what's happening. This is why I'm doing this. This is where we're going. This is why this is so meaningful." And it's a crying shame that many times people who are on Christian college campuses pay the price of educating the world in the doctrine of God. They pay the price with their own children. Why? Maybe it's because they're so busy fighting they don't have time to sit down and tell the younger ones why they're fighting. But then secondly, you might find another practical reason. It just simply may be that whenever they rested, they were so tired they didn't want to teach. In Joshua 11, it tells about the fighting. In Joshua 21, it tells about the resting. That God gave them rest, and that's what they were after. They needed to rest. But somewhere along the line, they fell into a fatal rut. This generation assumed that just because they knew the Lord, the next generation would too. And that's just not true. That's not true. How many of us as parents have children and we are assuming that just because we believe, they believe? I'll tell you what, it's fatal and it's not uncommon. It's not uncommon for a generation of people. Your granddaddy taught your father. Your father then taught you. Have you continued this chain right on down, and have you taught your children? Or are you one of those who assumes that because my grandfather knew the Lord and my father knew the Lord and I knew the Lord, that my children will know the Lord? That's just not true. That's a false assumption. And I'm convinced that that's what happened. Apostasy is always just a generation away. You just start being the link in the chain, or the chain link that does not carry on and communicate the Lord to the next generation, and you'll be the one that will be responsible for the apostasy. Look, let me document it again. The entire church of the first 3 centuries did not survive in those locations. No! The first 3 generations, the first 3 centuries rather, the church in the first 3 centuries eventually, one by one, ceased to exist. By the time of Paul, danger signals were so imminent and were so evident that Paul warned the people about it. By the time that John came in about the year 90, by the time he was approaching his death, he issued not only warnings, but he just simply threatened them. The Lord threatened some of the churches in Asia Minor. He said, if you don't repent, I'm going to come and remove your candlestick. That was an imminent threat. To Ephesus, he said that. By the time it got down to Constantine in the 3rd century, or in the 4th century, the 300s, the church that was established in the day of Pentecost by the Lord's apostles had reached such a state of deterioration that it barely resembled the church of the 1st century. It had many things about it that still were identifiable, yes, but it had already gotten so far away from it that it was just about beyond retrieving. And from the dark ages until this present hour, the majority of history and the majority of the headlines of all the newspapers of all the world have been dominated by a religious movement that very little resembles the church of the 1st century whatsoever. That's right. Let me ask you a question. Where is the church? Where is that body of believers that met in Jerusalem? Where are they today? They're not in Jerusalem. The church that was so vibrant in the 1st century, the church that was so alive, the church that had continued in the apostles' teaching, the fellowship, and the breaking of bread, and the prayers, the church that said that nothing of their own belonged to them, and they pooled everything and had everything in common, the church to whom the Lord added daily those that were being saved. Where are those people? Where is that body of people? It's not in Jerusalem anymore. Where is the great church at Antioch? The great missionary church, the Gentile church that spread the kingdom of God all over the known world. Where is that great church? It had so many great teachers, so many great preachers, so many great Christians, and yet it's not even existing today at all. Where is the church at Philippi, the model church, the one in whom Paul gloried so? Where is it? Where is the church at Ephesus, where Paul spent 3 years, where Timothy spent years working, where John spent his declining and finally his retiring years, where history or tradition says that Mary, the mother of Jesus, went and lived with John, and they lived in Ephesus? Where is that church? Where is the church at Corinth, to whom more religious instruction was written than any other church in the history of the New Testament people? Where is that church? Where is the church at Philippi and at Ephesus and at Corinth and at Smyrna? Where are all these places? Where is the church in Rome, whose faith in the 1st century was noised all over the world? Where is that church? I'll tell you what, I've walked over the ruins of one of these after another. Izmir, Turkey, where Smyrna was. That church doesn't even exist there. The city of Izmir doesn't even exist. The city of Izmir does, but the city of Smyrna doesn't. Ephesus, it's a dung heap. It's ruins. Doesn't have a city there anymore. Ephes, yes, but not Ephesus, where the church was. And the church isn't in Ephesus. And you find all these different places, all of them, except Jerusalem and Rome that I've mentioned. What happened to the rest of these? Well, was it just economic shifting? Was it just the fact that as the trade routes shifted over the world at that time, due to the vicissitudes of fortune and whatever may be shifting in there in the history of people, is that what caused the cities to decline and to not be anymore, and Christians to have to shift to other places? Well, that may be part of the explanation. Was it just warfare and carnage? Was it the Saracen invasion by the Mohammedan warriors out of down in Arabia? Is that what caused Christianity to just disappear in all that whole continent? You can't find a Christian in Turkey today. Oh, you may find one, but he'll be very reluctant to admit it. It's against the law. The Saracens invaded and finally settled into Asia Minor in what is today known as Turkey. Well, that may explain something of what happened to the church in the first century. But that's not really the explanation. Somewhere along the line, somebody failed to be the connecting link. Economics doesn't explain it. War doesn't explain it. The warnings of the apostles went unheeded. Paul told the Ephesian elders, and this is in Turkey, he said, I commit you to God and to the word of his grace. And he made them this charge, take heed to yourselves and to the church over which the Holy Spirit has made you bishops to feed the church of the Lord. And then he said, take heed. He said, the day is coming when there will arise from among you men who will speak perverse things, attempting to draw aside the disciples after themselves. And sure enough, it happened. In the second letter that he wrote to Timothy, chapter 3, he says that in the later times, there are going to come times of stress. And he says that men will not know God any longer. They'll love themselves. They'll love pleasure. They'll love money. But they won't love God. Paul says that's coming. And then in chapter 4, he makes the charge, I charge you in the presence of God and of Christ Jesus, who is to judge the living and the dead, and by his appearing in his kingdom, preach the word. And then he tells why. For the time is coming when people will not endure sound teaching, but having itching ears, they'll accumulate for themselves teachers to suit their own likings, and will turn away from listening to the truth and wander into myths. That's what would happen. That's what did happen. But you ask yourself the question, and let history then, later on, let us hear the question that will come 100 years from now. Whatever happened to the church in Circe? Whatever happened to that body of people who were so strong, who were so determined to carry on the work of the Lord? Whatever happened to them? And perhaps somebody will come and there'll be a pillar here and maybe a part of a wall here and all of this covered with rubble. Whatever happened to those people? Well, perhaps some of them moved away. That's right. Many of you will be every year. But that won't be the explanation why this church doesn't exist if it doesn't exist 100 years from now. You know what the difference will be? The difference, or the factor, will simply be this. Some of us to whom the word was committed didn't pass it on to other people. You see, we're in what you call a relay race. We're all in a race. Hebrews the 12th chapter and verse 1 says, let's run with patience this race that's set before us. But really, we're in a relay race. A relay race with Peter and Paul and John and Justin Martyr, who lived after John, who's one of John's disciples, and Ignatius and Irenaeus and all these. We're in a relay race with these people. They were the first ones. They passed it on down. John passed it on down to Justin the Martyr. And then Justin the Martyr passed it on down to somebody else. And then someone else to somebody else. And then someone passed it to my grandfather, Talbert Fanning Woodruff. And then my grandfather passed it to my daddy, Claude Harding Woodruff. And then my daddy passed it to me. And I'm making an effort to pass it to my children, my own children, and you as my children. I'm making that effort. Men like Dr. Benson and Brother Merritt and Brother Croom and Brother Sears, these men that represent the older generation, they've passed it on down to me and my generation. That's right. And it's a baton, just like in a relay race. They have taken it with good, firm grip, and they've placed it in my hand without any question at all. They want us to be preaching it. And now I am making an effort to take it and place it in your hand, Mitch, and yours, John, and yours, Sally, and whoever you may be. We're making an effort to pass it on to you for this simple reason, so that what was given by the Lord Jesus Christ and passed on to his apostles, which they in turn passed it to others, and they in turn to others, that we can in turn pass it on to you, so that you in turn can pass it on to your children and others, and it'll just keep going. That's the task ahead of us. We're in a relay race. I accept this baton from those men. Brother Merritt, I accept this baton from you. Young people, do you accept this baton from me? They're going to be those of you that are just spectators. And mark my word, if it comes to being passed on from you to others, the church will die and go to hell. It'll never be passed on. There are some who come and you find peanut wrappers, you find everything, you find gum wrappers, you find Coke bottles here in the building. And it's not that just everybody that sits in the balcony, that's not it. The balcony hadn't got anything to do with it. It's wherever you can get to be least noticed and come in last and leave first. You're the spectators. And the world will split hell wide open if it depends upon the spectators of any generation. I don't know what you're planning to do with your lives. Many of you spectators perhaps will come to your senses later on. But the point I'm making this morning is that we have received a charge. I've been given a charge. I've been handed this baton and I accept it. I then am handing it to you. Will you accept it? A man told me last Thursday night, he said, I am expecting the churches of Christ to play a very prominent role in the history of America in the next 20 years. This man was not a member of the church. But this man had come to see that we believe the Bible, and he was pulling out of a church that he said does not believe the Bible. He was casting his lot, and he's studying. He wants to be a part of us. He said, I'm looking forward to the churches of Christ. I predict that they'll play a very prominent part in the next 20 years. But you know who'll have to play it if it's played? You. Because in 20 more years, I'll be on my way out. And if you don't take the baton, nobody else is going to take it. And you'll be the leaders because of your being here in this school situation where you're learning more and training more and preparing yourselves. You're going to have to take the baton. Can you do it? Yeah, you can do it if you will. Let me just simply say, Brother Merritt, as you say, I'm giving you this baton, Jim. Do you accept it? I say, I do. Let me ask all of you, will you? Will you answer me this morning? I want you to understand the question. Will you accept this baton? And as I pass it on to you, if you will, say, I will now. Do you mean that? All right. Apostasy is always just one generation away. We're in this relay race, and it's been handed to me. The buck stops with me, and I'm going to pass it then on to you as I have opportunity. Will you accept it? The Apostle Paul told Timothy, the things that you've heard from me in the presence of many witnesses, the same commit thou to faithful men and women, but faithful men who can teach others also. That's our challenge. That's our task. We're going to talk tonight about what Jesus wants most of all. We're going to talk about what is the baton. What is this baton? What is it that was committed to them in the first century? There are some differences. Oh, you're going to run different. Did you ever see a relay race? People run differently. Dr. Benson runs my legs off, for one thing. He just runs. Goes like a cat, you know, with his tail on fire. Here he just goes all the time. That's really not a good description of him, but you'll forgive me. But that's the way he runs. It just goes day and night. Others run differently. Some run with a hitch in their get-along, but they're running. And on certain legs of the race, you think, oh, me, we're going to lose it because old such is, he's got endurance, but he hadn't got speed. And then we get to another leg of the race, we say, oh, boy, we're going to catch up because old so-and-so, he's got speed, he hadn't got much endurance, but watch him burn that track up. And so we catch back up, but everybody has his own style of running. Every generation is going to have its own style of running, too. You're going to dress different. You're going to preach different. You're going to talk different. You're going to do things in a different way. But there is a baton that's got to be handed on down. And I'm urging you, don't change the baton. You can run differently, but don't change the baton. Secondly, don't drop the baton. You can run differently, but don't drop the baton. That's right. These two things are absolutely essential. We're going to talk about what the baton is tonight. But don't drop it and don't change it. This is your commission. This is your charge. And if we fail this charge, we shall forever die. A charge to keep I have. A God to glorify. This is our challenge. This is our task. And I urge you to be about your business. You've already accepted it. If you didn't say vocally, I do, and if in your heart you mean it, may God bless you. And as we stand and sing this song of commitment, we're going to urge you, if you want to make a public statement of that, to come while we stand and sing.